This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Hollywood has a big problem. From May through Labor Day, U.S. box office revenue is down 15% from last year. Summertime is supposed to be a gold mine with blockbusters like Jaws, Finding Nemo, Men in Black, Forrest Gump, and all three of the original Star Wars movies. Some in Hollywood are blaming this summer on the critics, who apparently have more power than ever.
That's because we were in lifeguard pursuits.
Oh, okay. My bad.
Except for there's no such thing as lifeguard pursuit. Police do pursuits. When you do it, it's just some guys chasing some other guys. No offense.
None taken.
The big budget adaptation of Baywatch made less than $19 million when it debuted in May. Apparently, only 18% of critics gave Baywatch a positive review. Hence, it got an 18% rating on the website Rotten Tomatoes. Critics of the site say its bite-sized reviews are driving audiences away from films they might have otherwise given a chance. Others say that's overblown. Rotten Tomatoes also makes money from selling movie tickets, and the top-grossing movie is not always the highest rated. How much power do sites like Rotten Tomatoes really have to make or break a movie? And how much do studios need to just own up to making some rotten films? Joining us from NPR West in Culver City, California, is Brooks Barnes, who covers Hollywood and the film industry for The New York Times. Brooks, welcome to 1A.
Hi, how are you?
Good to have you. Joining us from WYPR Public Radio in Baltimore is Anne Hornaday, the chief film critic for The Washington Post. And welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
And at NPR in New York, Daniel Loria is the executive director of Box Office Media, a trade publication that focuses on movie theaters and the box office. Daniel, glad to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Daniel, I wonder if we might start with you. Can you paint us a clearer picture of this summer's box office? We gave just the raw number, 15% down from last year. Could you flesh that out for us a little further in terms of, you know, what the numbers say and whether this is unusual?
Well, I think the word we have to keep in mind for the summer was that it was disappointing, certainly not alarming. The numbers were certainly down. It was a very disappointing season. But when taken into context of the year as a whole, we're going to see that summer really isn't the whole story. We're coming off a record-breaking first quarter and looking at a very strong fourth quarter coming up. I think the slide in the summer has to do with perhaps outdated expectations for that movie season to carry the rest of the year. As an example, in 2012, six of the top 10 grossing films domestically came out during the summer. But since 2014, only four of the top grossing films have come out during that season. That has to do with scheduling from the studios in putting out these big sort of blockbuster movies throughout the year and not putting them all together, bunching them up all together in that very small three-month season.
Brooks Barnes, can you give us a little more context of what Hollywood is saying about Rotten Tomatoes? Some executives have apparently made no secret of their deep disdain, if not hatred, for Rotten Tomatoes, but how widespread is that?
Not open hatred.
Not open hatred, right.
It's pretty widespread, and the reason really boils down to two things. It's never Hollywood's fault. They make great movies you should love.
Well, of course they do. Don't you know that?
Right, you know, right. And the other thing that really is going on with Rotten Tomatoes is that they hate that they've lost control of the narrative, meaning that, you know, these are people who for decades have been able to tell moviegoers what they will like this weekend. You know, the number one comedy in the land, according to someone. And now, you know, with the internet in general, people are able to access all sorts of opinions, and Rotten Tomatoes has just become more and more and more visible. And in particular, over the last year, a big change happened where it changed corporate ownership. And so now it's part of the Fandango online ticket company, which is owned by NBC Universal. And so now when you go to Fandango to buy a ticket, the little Rotten Tomato score and logo, rotten or fresh, is right next to it. So you're basically looking right at a sign saying, you know, you're an idiot if you buy this ticket,
right.
if it's rotten.
And Hornaday, I think we should note that not every movie this summer did poorly. Here is a clip from another film this summer that did a lot better than Baywatch.
Fighting does not make you a hero.
What if I promise to be careful? Just a shield then.
Diana.
No sharp edges.
Be careful of mankind, Diana. They do not deserve you.
That was from the trailer for Wonder Woman, which came out in June and grossed $412 million domestically, scored 92% on Rotten Tomatoes. And what did you think of the movies this summer? They weren't all bad, were they?
Not at all. As a matter of fact, if anything, maybe my expectations have been so worn down over 20 years that that I'm so happy when one or two, are mildly okay. But I was actually pretty impressed with the quality of Wonder Woman. I thought Spider-Man was delightful. I thought War for the Planet of the Apes was incredibly well executed. I mean, these are those traditional summer comic book franchise movies that Daniel was referring to. And I think one lesson from last year that I do believe studios took to heart with the drubbing that Suicide Squad and Batman versus Superman took, not just by critics, but by viewers. I mean, everyone pretty much agreed that they were subpar in terms of execution. Execution matters. You know, it matters that these, even your kind of, CGI spectacle sequel to a sequel, needs to have a strong directorial point of view. It needs to be well written, well cast, well shot. I mean, all of those fundamentals still apply even when you're dealing with a movie that has the kind of built-in audience that Hollywood's been taking for granted for so long.
That's Washington Post chief film critic Anne Hornaday, alongside Brooks Barnes of the New York Times, Daniel Loria of the trade publication Box Office Media. And we'd love to hear from you, too. What do you think about sites like Rotten Tomatoes? Do you use them? Do you not use them? Do they help you make your movie-going decisions? What are the factors that really determine whether you go to a movie or don't go? Email us, 1A at WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Gail commented on our Facebook page, "I do check out the Rotten Tomatoes reviews with reviewers versus audience, both of which are on the page, and I have for years. I also get recommendations from friends. Additionally, I'm a big fan of indie theaters, which generally show better movies than the mainstream theaters. Like other posters, I'm tired of remakes. Doesn't anybody have original ideas anymore? This past summer was a virtual movie desert." Nick emailed, "I use Rotten Tomatoes more to figure out which movies to stream. The real issue is the amount of really bad content, such as Sharknado, that seem funny, but production makes them almost unwatchable. Rotten Tomatoes weeds those out for me." Daniel Loria, what about that? This idea of just having aggregated reviews. I mean, Gail said she gets recommendations from friends, and there's an aspect of that in Rotten Tomatoes that you're kind of hearing from people who are more like you, blended with critics, as opposed to just, like Brooks said, just hearing from the studio.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because a Rotten Tomatoes score isn't a movie review. There is no nuance to a tomato icon and a number. There is no discussion. There's no conversation around that. So I think whereas that sort of represents a consumer reports type score for the consumer, there's a whole other factor that we haven't been talking about, which is word of mouth, what other people are saying in your social circles about a movie. And through Twitter and Facebook and social media, word of mouth, not only people in your immediate circle, but also a little bit wider, their opinions and their viewpoints get to be shared in an instant live feed to you and indexed by a hashtag for whenever you want to consult that. So I think it's very important to say that film criticism isn't really part of this conversation because we're not speaking about the power of a specific critic or a publication. We're talking about a sort of anonymous score, and we haven't really factored in the effect of social media and what regular people are saying in 140 characters or less.
Brooks, do you find anyone in Hollywood? I know we got to pause shortly, but do you find anyone in Hollywood that maybe is doing the mea culpa and saying that absent a few movies, Hollywood has just kind of not been on its A game lately?
You find that privately, you know, but publicly it's always, well, you know, we had a bad stretch. We relied on the 8th installment of Alien. Maybe we shouldn't have. but it's always what's coming next. And this fall, you know, we had It already. That was certainly not an example of a dying movie business. It's been an absolute juggernaut. And there are movies like Thor coming up and another Star Wars. I mean, again, more sequels, but they're going to be absolutely massive is what the truth is. And that's what studios are always pointing toward.
Yeah. And certainly there's been a greater lesson that diversity makes a big difference at the box office, too. White Suburban Mom tweets, maybe if Hollywood made movies for people besides white 25-year-old males, they'd sell more tickets. See Wonder Woman and Girls Trip. And I might also add Get Out, reiterated that point also. We'll continue our conversation in a moment with Brooks Barnes of the New York Times and Hornaday of the Washington Post and Daniel Loria of Box Office Media. We've been talking a lot about how movies do here in the U.S. We will factor in global box office when we come back. And later in the hour, we'll shift gears and speak to folk musician Josh Ritter about his 9th album called Gathering. I'm Joshua Johnson. Glad to be with you. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing this summer's rocky season at the box office and what the website Rotten Tomatoes might have had to do with it, with reporter Brooks Barnes of the New York Times, film critic Ann Hornaday of the Washington Post, and analyst Daniel Loria of Box Office Media. Before we get back to that conversation, we would like to let you know about the next meeting of the 1A Movie Club. It's coming up next week. This time we will be seeing Battle of the Sexes, a fictionalized portrayal of the legendary 1973 tennis match between Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs, a former world champion and a serial hustler.
Hello?
Eureka, Billie Jean!
It's Bobby Riggs. I had a great idea. Male chauvinist pig versus hairy leg feminist.
You're still a feminist, right?
I'm a tennis player who happens to be a woman.
Don't hang up.
By the way, I shaved my legs.
Battle of the Sexes stars Emma Stone as Billie Jean King and Steve Carell as Bobby Riggs. It debuts nationwide this Friday. We will discuss it here next Thursday. And we'd love to hear your review of the movie. On a scale of 1 to 5 stars, how many stars would you give it and why? Leave us a voicemail with your review, 855-236-1A1A. That's 855-236-1212. We will review the movie Battle of the Sexes, spoilers and all, and share some of your reviews next week on 1A. Let's get to a few more of your comments about Rotten Tomatoes. Caleb wrote on our Facebook page, I go to the movies often with my family, sometimes 3 or 4 times a month. We always check the reviews on Rotten Tomatoes. More than once, we've gone to see a movie we've never heard of because it had a high Rotten Tomatoes score. It's rarely, if ever, led us astray. Brooks, I wonder what evidence the film industry has that Rotten Tomatoes is ruining its business. Can any studio point to one movie, where there was a clear causal link between Rotten Tomatoes and the box office revenues?
They point to a couple over the summer. One was Baywatch that you mentioned. They also point on the high end to Wonder Woman that, you know, it's not all they complain on the weekend that it goes down, and they are kind of silent on the weekends that it goes up in their criticism of the site. I think that, you know, there's nothing firm, but it's not like Rotten Tomatoes makes or breaks, but it certainly there is evidence that it goes up and down. And it's sort of to that other point that it's not just the site, but then on social media, people start changing, you know, oh, this got a X score or this was rotten. And that sort of, you know, way of discussing movies has become, it just spreads like wildfire. And so you can see when a when you look at the tickets in a very granular ticket sales in a very granular way, how so the word of mouth and it just starts going down, down, down.
But in terms of, you know, Baywatch tanking because Rotten Tomatoes said it was bad, as opposed to Baywatch being bad, or Wonder Woman soaring because Rotten Tomatoes said it was great, as opposed to just Patty Jenkins directing a phenomenal movie and Gal Gadot just not knocking the role out of the park, we right. can't really prove that it was the website, can we?
Not at all. I mean, it's the scapegoat.
JP Gonzalez tweets, is there any market for bad movies like Mystery Science Theater 3000 or Riff Tracks? Am I weird as a consumer that I would want to go see a bad movie with friends? And I think there's a huge market for bad movies, isn't there?
Absolutely. And we have a movie about a bad movie coming out in a few in the next several weeks called The Disaster Artist, about the movie The Room, which is one of the, you know, it completely had a, it's had an incredibly vivid life as a cult bad movie. But I want to circle back to the conversation, you know, to what you and Brooks were just talking about, because I think often the scapegoating of reviewers and Rotten Tomatoes hides a fundamental misunderstanding of the audience. I mean, my question would be, who was the audience for the Baywatch movie? I mean, they're mm-hmm. continually overestimating, you know, the nostalgia that we have for these old TV shows and these old, you know, the Lone Ranger tanked because nobody really wanted to fundamentally see that movie. Conversely, something like A Girl's Trip, quote-unquote, overperforms, which is fancy speak and sort of polite speak for underestimating the core audience for that movie.
And we should be clear, you know, the core audience for that movie was black women.
Well, and women of all, I mean, you know, the audience I saw it with was women of all stripes and lots of dates. I mean, it's just a huge audience, period. You know, it's people who, mm-hmm. and I'd like to kind of associate that with Get Out and Dunkirk and The Big Sick, all of which did incredibly well, all of which are original movies, and all of which are the kind of movie, and I would put Wonder Woman in this too, even though it's not an original, it's an adaptation, but done with a very strong point of view by Patty Jenkins. These were movies that compelled you to the theater. I mean, these are movies that are exponentially more enjoyable seen with a group, whether it's to be scared together. That's why it's doing so beautifully well. I mean, these are movies that demand to be seen collectively rather than waiting for streaming, as the previous emailer indicated. Whether it's to be scared together, to laugh together, or to have that incredible visual experience that Christopher Nolan gave us with Dunkirk. So I think that those are all really interesting data points in terms of what Hollywood, the lessons Hollywood might take away from this.
Although, Anne, I kind of wonder maybe if movies like, say, Wonder Woman have higher stakes if a Rotten Tomatoes review is bad. I mean, you did mention that Warner Brothers and DC Comics had just been stung over Batman versus Superman, where Wonder Woman was a highlight of that movie, and people were like, I cannot wait to see that movie. And then mm-hmm. with Spider-Man Homecoming, the previous Spider-Man movies had fallen off really badly, so Sony really needed that film to do well. I wonder if there are certain genres where the review potentially could do more harm.
Well, you know, anecdotally, I have heard just from, you know, those few encounters I do have with people on that side of the business, I do, and Brooks and Daniel can certainly correct me if this is wrong, but I have always heard that negative reviews matter more than positive. In other words, if mm-hmm. someone's on the fence about seeing something, a negative review is more likely to keep them away from it than a positive review would be to convince them to go.
Daniel, what do you think about that?
Well, I think in terms of reviews, where it really makes an impact are for art house and indie titles, especially around award season. If a big summer movie doesn't get well reviewed, but it's a recognizable IP, it can still perform. But if there is an award season title where the entire marketing machine behind it is that it is going to be part of this elevated conversation, if that doesn't get good reviews, then I think you see a much deeper impact.
And I'm sorry, when you say IP, you mean an intellectual property, like Wonder Woman is an intellectual property of DC Comics.
Exactly.
Jake Flo tweets, it's interesting how different genres sort of have their own rating scale. For instance, horror movies are always rated poorly. 6 out of 10 equals good. Fred emails, my girlfriend and I are big horror movie fans. Critics almost always don't like horror movies, so my girlfriend and I have lowered our Rotten Tomatoes expectations for that genre. A horror movie that gets 40% on Rotten Tomatoes is worthy of our attention, whereas a drama or comedy at that score would not be. Esolikin tweeted, why should I go see a film in theaters when I can wait for it to come out on DVD a few weeks later? Home is comfier than a theater. Brooks, what about that? Just the home entertainment aspect, the Netflix aspect of how people are watching movies differently now.
It's huge. And that's really, from a business aspect, what the movie industry is grappling with, in that it's not... The public has moved in a lot of ways from a habitual approach to movie going, even if it's not every weekend, it's a habit, to what is a special event type situation where it, I think Anne used the word, compel you out of into the theater. And that's part of why you see them spending so much money on these huge, what they call tentpole movies. Every weekend in the summer, there's a movie that with marketing costs at least $300 million. And they're designed to play globally. And it's really something that they think will compete with Netflix. And that, so the impact of that, though, is that a whole tier of movies, the middle market movie, the one that costs maybe $30 million, the romantic comedy, all of that has gone away. They've ceded that part of the business to Netflix, Amazon, HBO.
And of course, we should be clear with regard to the comment on horror movies. Not all horror movies, of course, have been doing poorly. It, which is doing very well at the box office, scored 85% on Rotten Tomatoes. Get Out, the huge hit horror movie that came out earlier this year, scored 99% on the tomato meter. Daniel Loria, can you talk a little bit about domestic versus global box office? How does this fit in a larger sense to a company's bottom line? What happens here in the U.S. as it relates to online reviews and whether people show up at the theater?
Yeah, well, the first thing we have to realize is that there is no magic number that each big studio film has to hit in order to be a success. It all depends really on what that specific title is looking at, what its audience is, and if it's part of a larger franchise strategy for a studio. An example of that is The Mummy, which is part of a new sort of franchise that Universal is rolling out called The Dark Universe, which is going to be movies based on their great reputation of classic monsters. The Mummy being an example, Bride of Frankenstein, Dracula, and so on. The Mummy didn't do well here in the United States. It made around $80 million. But globally, it made $470 million, meaning that 80% of its theatrical gross came from outside of North America. And I think that's very important to sort of realize when we're talking about if a specific movie is a hit or a success for a studio or not. The Mummy is meant to roll out longer series of films that are going to follow it. And with that first release, we saw something very clear. Not even Tom Cruise could really push that to be a success in the US, but overseas, there is a lot of interest. And it's going to be interesting to see how that sort of develops moving forward.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Brooks, what about that? I mean, you do have a much greater emphasis on global box office as the years go on, especially with emerging markets like China. Does that mean that American filmgoers and reviewers are kind of losing their power as tastemakers in a way?
For certain films, absolutely. It's like it's almost, you know, I hate to break it to you, but studios don't care about you. look at two movies over the summer. And in fact, if you looked worldwide, the two biggest movies, Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Tell No Tales, I think was the subtitle, right. And Despicable Me 3. Both of those movies got reviews, and both of them underperformed in North America. They 36% or so behind the previous installment. That's bad. And so, you know, but then if you look worldwide, Despicable Me 3 took in almost $900 million worldwide for the number one movie of the summer. And so Universal is sitting there saying, well, I don't know why you're hammering on us. We did our job. Look, we have a movie that's absolutely gigantic. The problem with that is when, you know, to Anne's point, studios do have gotten the message about quality, but sometimes on these global movies, it's more important to them to sand down all the edges and have something that plays across, even if it's lower in the U.S. That you always hear something from studio executives that I find interesting. I don't know if it's true. often from studio executives, you have to have that qualifier. Mm-hmm. But it's that overseas audiences are less picky, if that's the right word, than American moviegoers, in part because they're not as worn out by these franchises. They're not bombarded with the characters in
right.
consumer products and in television and all of that.
Well, it's important. I should note that a number of you are not really impressed with Rotten Tomatoes as a source for reviews at all. Tom Smith emailed, "Is there a reason you haven't mentioned IMDb? Maybe it's me, but I find IMDb ratings more accurate to my viewing preferences than that of Rotten Tomatoes." Cal emailed, "Rotten Tomatoes is the charlatan of movie rating systems. IMDb is superior. It uses a weighted average and statistical methods, such as a trimmed mean and a weighting system, to prevent abuse." And Bob in Indianapolis emailed, "I love movies, but don't go often and never check Rotten Tomatoes. I look at other sources, but I'm retired and movies are very expensive. That's a driving factor for waiting until they're stream available. And this summer, sorry, the offerings were yawn." Anne Hornaday, I wonder, maybe as we're winding down our conversation, who do you look to determine whether or not a movie is worth your time? Yes, you're a critic, I get that. But whose voices do you listen to in terms of getting a second or third opinion on a film?
Oh, that's interesting. Because I'm a critic and I am living in abject fear of unconsciously plagiarizing, I do sort of stay in a bubble before the fact, before I weigh in on my own. But I think I'm probably pretty typical. I listen to friends. I listen to what's being talked about around the dinner table. I'm actually a fan of Metacritic, another aggregating site. I think as somebody who is, you know, one of the reviewers that they aggregate, I find that they're pretty accurate in terms of the way they characterize my feelings about a movie, and I feel pretty comfortable with whatever, I don't know, what algorithms or content analysis that they're using, but I think, by and large, I feel pretty good about it. To Brooks's, you know, to your discussion about the global market, though, even that is showing some signs of change, because this year, I think the biggest movie in China was a local China, you know, nationalist China project. This movie called World Warrior II. So as these indigenous movie, you know, as these movie markets are building up, so are their own indigenous movie cultures. So maybe, you know, I think that the certainties that Hollywood thinks apply may not apply.
And Daniel, very briefly, how do you see the film industry dealing with this trend going forward? Briefly.
With global grosses, it's going to continue as for the big movies, of course. But that does open up a lot of opportunities for smaller distributors during award season and beyond to get into that position to make the movies that bigger studios aren't making anymore. And that includes Amazon Studios.
Daniel Loria is the executive director and chief strategist at Box Office Media. Daniel, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Anne Hornaday is the chief film critic at The Washington Post. Anne, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And Brooks Barnes covers Hollywood and the film industry for The New York Times. Thank you, Brooks.
Appreciate it.
Krista Longton tweeted, "No matter how good TV is, I love the collective experience of going to the movies. I just wish films like The Big Sick would get more press." So did we. That's why we reviewed The Big Sick on the 1A Movie Club. And you can find all the films we reviewed on our website, the1a.org. Just search for the phrase Movie Club, and all the reviews will come up. The Circle, Wonder Woman, The Big Sick, and Detroit. And maybe we will get to your review of Battle of the Sexes when we meet for the 1A Movie Club again next Thursday. Coming up, we shift gears from movies to music in conversation with the modern Americana singer-songwriter Josh Ritter. That conversation is coming up in just a moment. Stay close.